See, it's a museum. So the wooden huts are numbered and serve some of the concrete buildings. So welcome to Hut 11, a hellhole, as it was known by the staff who used to work within it. In its day, this used to be a bomb-proof building, a solid reinforced concrete roof. The lights were only let in post-war. The only natural light and ventilation, therefore, through these tiny windows at the side known as escape hatches. But remember, in common with all the other buildings on the site, subject to blackout conditions. This building used to have two sets of double-locking doors. You weren't allowed to talk freely, you weren't allowed to walk freely. If you walked past this building, you were not allowed to see what was inside it. And this is beautifully evidenced in an interview given by a lady who worked in the hut next door for 4 years, and she never found out what was in here. Magic. It was known as the Hell Hole, which has been solid concrete in summer at radiates heat, and equally in winter, cold. This building used to hold certain machinery which at the end of the war was removed and or destroyed, so we have a depiction of it here. But before we discuss it, let's go back to the art of Coden Sachsworking. It is an art, basically, where you put pen to paper and follow various procedures, and hopefully if you're diligent in those procedures, you will break the code and or cipher, but you cannot quantify the time frame. Enigma was highly complex. It was also used by so many different authorities. As the theatre of war expanded, the sheer volume of traffic to be processed meant it physically impossible to have thousands of people putting pen to paper. There was a need to mechanise. Now, the Poles were mechanised pre-war. They had a machine called a bomber, but that machine, by its very design, was totally obsolete. Fortunately, Alan Turing came up with the concept of the machine, as equally did Gordon Welshman. Gordon Welshman, incidentally, was head of Hut 6, very, very senior here, promoted on to be deputy director in charge of overall mechanisation, etc. So when he moved up the scale, his deputy, Stuart Mulderberry, took over as head of Hut 6. And it was Gordon Welshman that made the machine in question work. Maybe I'll tribute to the Poles. We call our machine a bomb. But this machine was very, very different to the Polish machine. This represents the front, and this the back. The whole purpose of this machine was to assist cipher breakers in establishing which rotors were physically in use by any one authority using Enigma any one day. So the concept is electromechanical. And on the electrical side, you could say the wirings replicate 36 individual Enigma machines. So remember what happens on a daily basis. The operators have a monthly sheet, and they're given a selection of three rotors from the five available. Each row of three discs represents an Enigma. 12 to a row, three rows, 36, excluding those three. The coloured discs, we'll only talk about the top row here, the coloured discs represent German numbered rotors. So for the sake of argument, it's going to be 1, 2, and 3. Representing again, right, middle, and left. Now, our guys were aware of the governing features adopted by the German cipher departments in the preparation of monthly sheets. And on certain occasions, they could come right up front with the suggested rotors that might be in use. And this is the machine that tested the proposition. Otherwise, they'd have to do certain hand calculations and then proper discs for checking. Around each disc, the 26 letters of the alphabet. Within each disc, a replica of the German wiring of the rotor in question. And behind each disc, little wire brushes which will hit a series of contact points. Having put these discs up for checking, what do you check them against? Now, you can't do it against a fixed machine, it's got to be something that's relative. So we now go back to Enigma. Despite all its complexities, it has got what can be considered as a simple design flaw. There is one function that Enigma cannot perform. It does not self-encipher. That is to say, if you press the letter L on the keyboard, the one above that cannot light up is the letter L. It's always got to be a different letter of the alphabet. If the next key presses A, the one above that cannot write up the letter A, again it's got to be a different letter of the alphabet. No self-incitement. Are you all happy with that? Mm-hmm. Military communications can be very regular and very standard. Now, for example, the German weather outstations used to send their reports in, weather forecasts or from the area, in book code, which we broke easily. The German Met Office would compile the weather reports and send them out in various formats. But we knew what the formats were. And on the naval side, or the marine side, you could say it was very nice, because they never changed the standard formula. Dogger, Malin, Fastnet. Hold on, it's sunny, it's foggy, it's rainy. We had a relationship of language which could be geared to a standard message. But the classic story comes from North Africa, where a small German unit, posted to a remote part of the desert, sets up camp, nothing's happening, so they send a message back to base. I have nothing to report. They go to bed and sleep well, wake up in the morning, all's quiet. The sun's up, sky's blue, delicate shimmers developing over the dunes. So what they do, they send a new message back to base. I have nothing to report. Our guys were listening in, realised the import of this. So a general instruction was given to all the Allied units, do not go into that part of the desert, do not attack that unit. And as a consequence, every day for 6 months, that unit sent the same message. I have nothing to report. So what they would do is, they would write out the encirclement. They would take the language text which they thought was relevant, and they would juggle it along. And they're looking for a point where no letter is the same. So if we start off in this position, you'll find letters the same. We move it up a bit, we've got letters the same. We move it up again, letters the same. And then suddenly you hit a magic point where no letter is the same. There is now a very high percentage of it that this part of the encirclement represents that language test. There is then a procedure for knocking out letters. Now you have to go to the books for this. So from what we call the crib, you end up with what we call the menu. And this is an example of what a wartime menu looks like. What is it? It's a sequence of letters. But remember, each original German letter represented by these discs has a different wiring. There is only one combination of discs, be it that, that, or that, if they're up here, which will allow this to happen. So this gets flat on the back, and that's what these get tested against. When the machine is switched on, the top row in each case will go fast, the middle row medium, and the bottom row slowly, following the theory. Every time you press a key on the Enigma, the right-hand row advances one letter at a time. So the sooner that disc does a full revolution, the sooner this goes one letter. The sooner that does a full revolution, the sooner that goes one letter. This machine could check 26 times 26 times 26 in 14 minutes flat. There were machines that could do it faster. Within the machine are relays which get shorted out when things are wrong. But if they hit the right sequence, right from the back, they'll cut in and stop this machine. An indicator comes up the back and tells the operator which row is involved. Three checking discs, spinning around a great speed, all come to a halt. The operator can wind the back and goes click, click, click. And they can find the start positions of the indicated discs. There is then a machine called a checking machine. We've rebuilt one, it's in our museum. And that would prove that the stop is valid. If it was valid, they'd call job up, strip everything down, put all these back on the racks, and the next selection could be gold, silver and blue, different menu on the back, and away they went again. Turnaround time, an hour and a quarter. In this building, some six machines. But there were in fact over 220 built. They were built by the British Tabulating Company at Letchworth under their Director of Engineering, Doc Keane. Too important to be at Bletchley Park, so after the initial delivery here, as they came in drips and drabs from the factory, they were initially installed at locally at outstation space at Adstock, Wavendon and Gayhurst. When the main bulk of machines got delivered, they went to North London, Stanmore and Eastcote. Over 1,600 Wrens were trained in the art of putting up these discs, programming them, this is the formula for that as well, checking with tweezers that little disc, the wire brushes behind each disc were kept in order, so they touched the short machine, plugging up the menus, conducting the runs. The servicing was done by RAF technicians. Every head of department at the end of the war wrote a report, and we have a copy of the bomb report written by Squadron Leader Jones. And it's recorded that these machines had a 95% performance record. Now think on that. They're working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year for the whole length of the war. And yet they were in operation for 95% of that time. So when you get home, have a look at your toaster, kettle, washing machine. Doesn't matter what appliance you've got at home, think of the quality of this machine. Because you won't last that long, I can assure you. You'll be lucky if you last a month in certain cases. Quite incredible. So we have a depiction of the machinery here, but the good news is my colleagues have rebuilt one. It's in our museum on the lower ground floor. The back is opened. You can see the simplicity of the engineering. But do remember that within each machine is a success of 12 and a half miles of wiring. Because obviously we're checking 26 times 26 times 26 letters of the alphabet. The sole machinery used by the authorities in helping to crack Enigma and proving which rotors were physically in use by any one authority using Enigma any one day. And at its peak, they were breaking in excess of what they call 50 radionets a day, twice a day, because the Germans kept upgrading systems. So there's a formidable volume of traffic being processed here at Bletchley Park. It was like a factory. It really was. Absolutely incredible. Now it always begs the question, if you've identified which rotors are in use, how do you convert an encircled text back to a language text? Well, again in our museum, adjacent to the bomb, you'll find another cipher machine called Titex, our own cycle machine. And when you look at it, you'll see it has a keyboard, it has plugging facilities, and above the keyboard, provision for rotors. Unlike Enigma, which was 3 from a series, ours was 5 from a series. And just to compound matters, the centres of each rotor were reversible. It was never broken by the Germans, and we don't actually know of anybody else who actually broke it. But our engineers were able to modify the Type-X to replicate an Enigma. So once the bomb had established which rotors were in use, replica rotors were put into a modified Type-X, the machine prepared, the Type-X could then sit there with a stack of intercepts of a particular radio net of day, type in the garbage, and off on the tape on the top right-hand corner hopefully came the language equivalent of that message. That bit of tape then stuck to the intercept and immediately transferred to the intelligence hub for translation, indexing, assessment, and onwards promulgation. Nice simple story? All happy?
Yeah.
That is the story of Enigma. So if you talk Enigma, think the bomb. If you talk the bomb, think Enigma, nothing else. Right, I now have another story, but I have a caveat. I'll tell it in here. If my colleague turns up with another talk, we have to leave this room instantly. Okay? Well, the good news is it's sunny outside, so it doesn't matter. I've got a hole. No, it's just people wondering why. Okay. The next story, because we were set many, many challenges during the war, emanates from the listening stations. Now, the listening stations were predominantly staffed by members of the Army, Navy, and Air Force, and of course they tended to listen into their counterparts. But there were other authorities assisting, members of the Foreign Office, Post Office, and even the Metropolitan Police. In the 1930s, the Metropolitan Police were experimenting with installing radios into police cars. But with the equipment they had in those days, they couldn't get a signal from Scotland Yard. So they converted a former nursing home at Denmark Hill and carried out their researches. When war was declared, they were invited to use that radio equipment to help scan the airwaves, listening predominantly for spy transmissions, but equally in assisting and monitoring diplomatic traffic emanating from various consulates and embassies in London. But amongst the equipment they had was some high-speed transmitting and receiving equipment. And on that equipment, early in 1941, they started to intercept high-speed transmissions from Europe, the characteristics of which were totally different to anything else coming over the airwaves. This was non-Morse traffic. These intercepts were submitted to Bletchley Park, and of course the experts were nonplussed. As a consequence, this traffic was constantly monitored and recorded. And then in August of that year, a particular signal was intercepted, which for the very first time was not signed off well received. Instead, their old Fritz effectively tapped back to Homer, the German, and said, "Sorry, old boy, I didn't get that, could you please resend?" Now, Homer, the German, was not a very happy bunny, because he had a rather long message, and he proceeded to make 2 major mistakes. We've got to go. If you go outside and turn left, please.
Thank you.